A creaky old house on the edge of a wind-whipped cliff overlooking the sea. It's the perfect setting for a ghost story. But why? What's at the heart of those settings and themes we return to again and again? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show features ghost stories, courtesy of Wonderfair Gallery in Lawrence. The first story you'll hear is by Megan Kaminsky. She'll take us back to that creaky old house by the sea. And just a warning to our listeners, this is a grown-up ghost story, and if you scare easily, you might want to take that into consideration. Here we go.
Caroline. Gerald liked to visit the house after work. Perhaps like isn't the word, though. It was more that he felt compelled to visit. Every afternoon at 5, he left the insurance office downtown. And each afternoon, he intended to drive back to his condo on the east side. He intended to send his resume out to contacts back in the city. He intended to box up his things and leave this place that had left him tired and gray and alone. But every afternoon, his red Camry turned the wrong way onto Banford Road and carried him out to the edge of town, to the house they once shared. Gentle creaks of the iron fence echoed soft, and sprouts of crabgrass came up through sidewalk edging. Each day he visited that house under the guise of checking for mail or ensuring that doors and windows were securely locked. It had been nearly 3 years, and still something prevented him from letting go, from putting it on the market, from moving back to the city from which he came. It was Caroline who persuaded him to leave the city and move to the house that had been her parents and their parents before that. Caroline's ancestors had landed on the craggy Maine coast countless decades before, and in marrying her, Gerald had become connected to the place as well. Not that he was particularly happy about it. Not long after moving to the coast, he began to think about ways to get back to the city. He volunteered for assignments that entailed travel and started to think of ways to convince Caroline that they had made a mistake. But Caroline loved the coast, and the fresh air seemed to do her good. She was pale and delicate when Gerald first met her. It often seemed like the city overwhelmed her. And while she was thriving in her childhood home, she was also developing habits and proclivities that bothered him. At first, there were just long walks down the back path, leading to the shore, and spare moments around the house when he would catch her whispering to no one in particular. But then she stopped sleeping in their bed through the night. He would wake in the dead of night and call her name throughout the house to no response. He would find her in the morning, sprawled across the wicker couch on the back patio, or feverish in some deep sleep in the front parlor chair. He began to see her less and less. She was often nowhere to be found when he returned from work, and she would appear late in the evening as if she never left. She started to grow distant, and her hair grew long and wild, its dark strands tangling into knots down her back. One October evening, Gerald arrived home late from a business trip to Dunstable. He threw his things on the floor of the front room, annoyed that Caroline wasn't there to greet him. When he woke in the morning, he was alone. He waited and waited each day, imagining she would just turn up. He'd gotten so used to her being away that he didn't think to worry. After a week passed with no signs of her, he decided to contact the police. They did a full investigation, but their only clue was a report of two figures on the cliffs late the evening of Gerald's return home. Caroline had no other living family besides Gerald, and the police tired of their fruitless searching. They found a body months later up the coast, too badly decomposed to identify definitively. The police decided it must be Caroline and closed the case. On that day, Gerald packed a suitcase and left the house, wondering if he ever really knew his wife. In the days after his move to the condo in town, Gerald had dreams filled with blues and greens and whispers. A sad, solitary bird late in the evening, warm figs, and his wife's soft fingers. Soon after the dreams began, he started taking drives back by the house. And not long after, he began dropping in, ambling through the fields, on the cliffs, and eventually into the dust-covered halls. The faded wood creaked under his feet with each gentle step. This had been his home for years, but he felt as if he were intruding. A rich perfume emanated from the walls covered with old wallpaper and peeling paint. It was strangely familiar. The damp air soothed him, caressing the dark hairs on the back of his hand. It made him drowsy, but he always left just before the sun could set. There were some things he did not need to remember. As weeks turned into months, Gerald became unlike himself. He fell into a wakeless sleep each night, sleeping well into the morning. He started visiting the house more often, constructing elaborate excuses for his absence at work. Each evening, he lingered on the edge of the lawn, stepping into the car and driving off just before the sun set, and his darker memories were able to settle into the place. But each departure just made him feel more of a pull to the house. One evening, just as he was about to leave, he thought he heard a voice coming from inside. He laughed out loud, thinking that he had allowed himself to visit a bit too freely with the past. But then he heard it again. Gerald put his car keys back in his pocket, opened the door to the iron fence, and slowly walked up the drive. He wasn't sure what compelled him. Every thought told him he should go back, but he continued on. He unlocked the double bolts on the door and stepped into the dark house. He reached for the lights, but something stopped him. He heard the voice again, beckoning him to the back porch. Gerald hurried through the house, and when he opened the door, he heard the creak of footsteps across the porch. The sun had set, but he could hear the gravel of the back path crunching under some weight. He hurried down the path, following twig snap and leaf brush in the darkness. Could Caroline have returned? Gerald felt his gut rising up into his chest. His heart vibrated against his ribs. Memories started to flood back, memories he wasn't sure he wanted to confront. The salt air, the dark water swirling below, a purple ribbon wrapped round a wrist. He reached the cliffs and searched the moonlit expanse. There, on the point overlooking the sea, he saw her. Caroline's white face reflected the light from the moon and from the water. Her hair was dark and tangled, and she was wearing the gray dress she wore the night she left. She had come home. He called to her, apologizing. Her voice soothed him in a strange timbre, pulling him towards her. Gerald reached out to catch her hand, but all he felt was cold air and then the frigid water of the sea.
Arg, that ending gives me the chills. That was Megan Kaminsky reading her story, Caroline, from 100 Ghost Stories, a project spearheaded by Wonder Fair in Lawrence. We're joined by the owner and curator of Wonder Fair to talk with us this morning. Meredith Moore, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. It's so nice to be here.
What is the 100 Ghost Stories project?
100 Ghost Stories began 2 years ago as a gallery show that was also a print portfolio, where I got together a group of 10 artists to make Halloween mask prints that we would present in a portfolio called 100 Ghost Stories based on the Japanese tradition of the same name, but, you know, in Japanese, which I can attempt. I will butcher this, but Halloween pun. So the Japanese term would be Hayaku Monogatari Kaidankai. And So based on that tradition, which we can go into a little bit later, we had this exhibition of Halloween mask prints, but we also wanted to get some original ghost stories in play. So I got together with my writer friends, Justin Runge and Kate Lorenz, and they helped choose 10 writers who would each write an original ghost story, which we would then publish in a zine alongside the masks. So that's the nutshell. The project, of course, has grown a bit larger, but that was its inception.
Very cool. And this story that we just heard is from that project. It's one of the stories you've collected. What appealed to you about the story we just heard in particular?
Well, Megan Kaminsky is a poet. And I think that when you read her prose, you can sense that. And I think poetry has a way of being very evocative of feeling. And when Megan writes a ghost story, she does it in a way that she uses pauses and language in a way that calls to mind different colors, so your brain starts to really see the scene. And that's what makes it a very effective ghost story, is it paints the picture so thoroughly and poetically.
And until, vividly.
Vividly until that last splash. And that's one thing I really love about Megan's ghost story, is it's not all about the creep factor. The creep is slow, and it's... And it lingers.
I also want to get a reaction to that story from our other guest who's with us in the studio. Loie Lockerby is a film critic who works for the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library. Hi, Loie.
Hi.
So any familiar themes worth noting in the story we just heard? Any familiar techniques?
Well, the whole sense of isolation, either physical or emotional or psychological, I mean, that's at the heart of most ghost stories. And in this case, you have the, you know, the classic old mansion on the cliff, and, you know, and someone's behavior changing, which gets into that, do you really know the person you're with, or is there some history in this house that's affecting her? You know, there's always that element of mystery too, which I think is all very powerful with ghost stories.
Along with that, I think is the modern trend that perhaps you can't trust the narrator of a ghost story, which
could
is
be
sort of Gerald in this case. And I think that we don't always know that he's telling us the full story, and I think that's part of what's cool about it.
Yeah.
You see that in movies a lot, too.
I mean, it works better in literature, too, because it's more internal.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of get away with that in a way that's harder to do on film.
In movies, are the scary things that happen pretty consistent across time periods and cultures, or do we fixate on different things in different times and places? So, like, being alone, isolated in a big mansion, is that kind of all times and places that is a scary setting?
Yeah, I mean, even more recent ghost stories, The Woman in Black, which takes place in Edwardian England, just came out a few years ago, and the sequel's on its way. Even stories that take place in a big city or a suburb or something, there's still the sense that as soon as you walk in the door of that house or that apartment or whatever, you're completely closed off from the rest of the world. There was a movie called Oculus that came out recently that was sort of a ghost story, I guess. And, you know, they're just in the middle of the suburbs, nice average house. And I think that affects people now more because it resembles where they actually live and what they actually do. But, yeah, there's always that sense of being just closed off and that you're trapped with whatever this thing is that's haunting you.
Meredith, in this Japanese tradition that you referenced, were there sources of spook that that were unfamiliar to you as a 20th and 21st century American?
I don't know that they were unfamiliar to me, but I think there's a really interesting cultural divide between the ghost stories that would have been told back in the 17th century and even before in Japan and what we hear now. So, and should I talk about a little bit how the tradition works? I think it's really interesting
and
helps you understand how you could tell 100 ghost stories in a night, because it seems like that would take too long, right?
It does.
So in the tradition, it's quite literal. There were, supposedly, it started in the samurai classes, and these samurai, very brave samurai, would get together in their homes, and there'd be three adjacent rooms. They would light 100 candles in the third room and gather in the first room. And each would take a turn telling a ghost story and then would proceed to the third room to blow out a candle until eventually 100 stories had been told and 100 candles doused, covering them in darkness. And that was the moment that you could evoke the spirits that you'd been calling upon. And you, this was a show of your bravery and maybe a way to, like, force fear away, right? So eventually this trickled down into the worker classes as well. And they would tell stories that simply explained natural phenomena that were kind of wacky. Like, there's this rock in our town that weeps, and then there would be a ghost story told that took maybe 2 minutes, and it explained the weeping rock in a fantastical way. And that's what their ghost stories were doing, was explaining phenomenon, not simply trying to scare people, but like trying to make sense of a crazy world in a more fun and exciting way. Well, so that's the long story.
Well, that is really interesting, because that's a on the one hand, kind of a similar purpose to explain the unexplainable, but on the other hand, the idea that you are doing something about it, that you're confronting something.
Yep, making it your own, putting a story around your fear kind of encapsulates your fear, so that you can look at it for a longer time, a little bit more. Safely, perhaps, and amongst the company of your 99 friends. Must have been a huge, huge house. I don't know.
So, Loey, why do you think people like to be scared for entertainment today in America?
Well, I think she hits on something, that there's a universal desire to sort of face our fears and overcome them in some way. And this is a safe way to do it. You know, you read a scary book, you tell a scary story, you watch a scary movie, go to the haunted house, ride the roller coaster, whatever. It's a way to kind of deal with that fear, that dark side, and do it in a way that keeps you safe.
Central Standard is going to take a short break. We'll hear a couple more stories from Wonder Fair's 100 Ghost Stories project when we get back. Later in the show, Royals and Politics. Don't go away. And we're back. Happy Halloween. It's a ghost story edition of Central Standard, and we have one more truly scary story to share with you. After that, we'll do a funny scary story, and we'll look back on last night's baseball game. But for now, back to the ghost stories. Some listeners might find this one disturbing, and I'll go ahead and say it probably isn't a great one for the kids to hear. It's by BJ Hollers, and it's called Monitored.
When she first heard the voice over the baby monitor, she took it for her own. After all, she was the only one in the house with a voice. The baby's father was out of town on a sales call, and while she hated to be alone with someone so terribly fragile, the baby's arms felt boneless, like rubber bands. Her husband had reminded her that air conditioners wouldn't sell themselves. "You'll be fine," he'd assured her, but her own safety was never her concern. What concerned her was what she would do when she inevitably dropped the baby, or forgot to feed the baby, or wrapped the baby too tight in a sheet. She knew there would come a night when she left the window open, or the stove on, or the front door slightly ajar. If she didn't harm him directly, who might she allow to harm her perfect blue-eyed boy? Her mother and sister deemed these thoughts cause for concern. "Call me," her sister pled, taking her hands. "If you're feeling low, like you might do something, just call me." "But how will I know when I might do something?" she asked. "Just call me," repeated her sister. This was days before, back when her husband filled the empty space beside her on the bed. Now it was midnight and she was alone, the bedroom dark except for the red glow of the baby monitor. When the voice first came through, she'd watched that red light multiply, a rainbow of red suddenly clicking up their scale.
"Baby?"
The voice echoed like gravel inside a tin drum.
"Are you there, baby boy?"
She'd kicked off her sheets, but found herself unable to go to the nursery. Her feet were no longer her feet, but two thick bricks, and as she lay there, sweating, she wondered, did those words come from this mouth? She'd been alone with the baby all day and hadn't dropped him once, hadn't even allowed those rubber band arms to stretch unnaturally. When her perfect blue-eyed boy had cried, she'd fed him. And when he'd wet himself, she'd changed his diaper too. I am a mother, she'd reminded herself as she laid him down for his nap. I am acting just like a mother would. As the baby napped, she'd loaded the dishwasher, scrubbing hard at his milk-stained bottles before cramming the tubes neck down on the metal fingers. As she scrubbed, she'd heard a rattling from outside, and she peeked out the open kitchen window to spot a grinning man, her neighbor, fiddling with the antenna atop his roof. "For my police scanner," he'd said, nodding down to her. "Just trying to increase my signal." She'd nodded and attempted a smile. "Noticed Arnold's out of town," the neighbor had said, biting his tongue while maneuvering the metal between his sausage fingers. "You know my husband?" she'd called up to him. "Course," the man winked, pointing the antenna toward her home. "Least I know he's out of town." After his nap, the baby bathed, the baby sobbed, the baby slept. And when he was down for the night, his blue eyes closed, she turned her frazzled reflection to the mirror and thought, "You know, I closely resemble a mother." It had been a good day alone with the baby, and though Arnold had forgotten to call, she promised herself she'd tell him all about it in the morning. How he had been right. Everything had been fine, and she had kept their baby safe. "He is still perfect," she would tell him, "our blue-eyed baby boy." But then came the voice over the monitor.
"Baby, are you in there?"
If it was not her voice, then whose?
"Don't worry, baby,"
called the voice.
"I'm coming for you now."
If it weren't for the monitor's red rainbowing lights, she never would have believed it. The voice was simply a crossed signal, or a reverberation, or a fixed frequency come unfixed. Surely there was some logical explanation, and all she had to do was convince her brick feet to move to the nursery and convince her brick hand to twist the knob. All she had to do was peek inside the crib of her blue-eyed boy and see that he was still perfect. Suddenly she was doing it. Her feet were moving, but as she twisted the doorknob to the nursery, she heard a banging at the front door. "Your baby's in trouble," cried a voice. "Please, I picked your signal up on my scanner." She was relieved to find that she had not left the front door ajar, and she opened it, staring at her frightened neighbor, staring back. "Your baby's in trouble," the neighbor said, bursting into the house. "I heard a voice. There was a voice." The mother ran into the nursery and peeled back the sheets, and there was her baby, perfect and blue-eyed and breathing. "He's fine," she cried, turning to face our neighbor. "Oh, thank God, he's fine." The man grinned, and with a voice like gravel inside a tin drum, assured her that he was not.
And that gives me the creeps. It's so such a perfectly told, perfectly written scary story, and truly terrifying.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I've been thinking about that one for 3 years now. Since it was written.
Okay, that was Monitored by BJ Hollers. The story really teeters on the fine line between horror and psychological drama. Can we talk about that? Ghost stories that put the audience in the position of not knowing what's real and what's not?
Well, and I mean, in this case, actually both of the stories we've heard, they're not strictly speaking ghost stories. Because they could be, you know, purely psychological. They could be just some nutcase lives next door, you know. But it's very common, I think, because people don't – they know that they can't always trust their own brains. And, you know, more and more we learn about neurology, the more we learn that our minds play some pretty spectacular tricks on us.
There were a couple of moments where in this room I could see the reactions becoming – there were clear reactions to the story and moments. What are the moments that you would isolate Meredith as like the, oh my God?
I've read it so many times now. I think that I now fixate on the language. So I think about new mothers and how terrifying that truly is. Like even when your neighbor is not a homicidal maniac, it's just very terrifying. And the way BJ describes the baby's rubber band arms and like just the fragility of the baby and your complete, you know, you have no idea what you're, you should not be allowed to just have this precious thing in your control, right? So I think about all the way BJ describes the fragility of the baby, and I think now I fixate on that. But I think I felt differently before. Maybe Loey, who's fresh to the story, will have other things to say.
And I do want to talk about, though, that theme of, I mean, there are a couple things there, that the fragility of the baby is terrifying, but also that the power of the parent is terrifying. The parent being afraid of herself or maybe himself in the case of a father possibly telling a similar story.
Right. I think that's what makes this story so scary, is it reveals to yourself all the fears you might. I'm not a parent and don't plan to have kids, but I imagine every parent out there right now is just as scared of themselves as their neighbor, like I said.
Yeah, and it gets back to the isolation thing. Her husband's gone. She's alone with the baby. She doesn't quite trust herself. She doesn't know this weirdo neighbor. You know, it's even with people around you, you can be alone. And in her case, it's very psychologically astute, too, because she's nervous. She's a first-time parent. She's not sure she can do this. And you know, the moment you hear the voice on the baby monitor, you know, that's my, Electronics have been used in ghost stories a lot recently. I think there's that slight fear of technology and the fact that you can use it to freak people out. Computers and videotapes and phones and monitors and things like that.
And that you can be afar and present at the same time, like that the voice is disembodied and she can't know where it's coming from, because technology does kind of do that to you a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. And it has a very weird effect on our lives even normally, so it's easy to make it scary.
I thought of a moment that I would call out that always makes my skin crawl in that story, which is when she describes her neighbor fiddling with the antenna with his sausage fingers. And when you read it, at least in writing, and you picture like those fumbling fingers, that always gives me the willies.
The grin gets me.
Oh, the
scary people shouldn't grin.
Well said, particularly at Halloween time.
Yeah. No grinning. The pacing of the story, I think, is also part of what's scary, is that I think there's a danger of trying to make it scarier and scarier and scarier and never pulling back and giving a moment of maybe it's okay, that she's in bed thinking everything's gone fine. See, I'm going to say how everything was fine. That moment, I think, first, that is actually the scariest time, because when always in the movie, when the person's like,
he's dead.
Unaware.
Oh, wait.
Yeah. What is it about that? Why is it that everything seeming to have gotten better is exactly the scariest moment?
Well, I think a lot of storytellers use that to mess with you, you know, to try to lull you a little bit, and then bam. But, you know, maybe there's some primal instinct there, too, is we have to be on guard, because if we're not, you know, the saber-toothed tiger is going to eat us or something. So we have to keep telling ourselves not to relax too much.
Loey, we've all seen bad attempts at scary movies, and those have their own campy appeal. Sometimes that's done on purpose. But when a scary movie goes wrong, not on purpose, what are some of the typical reasons? Could that shed light on how you do this well? Like, how do people do it not well?
Well, I think if you've seen a lot of these kind of movies, you can kind of spot the cliches. And I used to do this thing with bad horror movies where they do what we call the cat scare, where it's something makes a person jump, but it's not really anything supernatural. And then you can literally count off 1, 2, 3, he's behind you, you know. And it gets to a point where it's just too easy to predict everything that's going to happen or every stupid thing the characters are going to do. But a lot of it is about just pacing and using the space. I saw The Conjuring last year, which I thought was a wonderfully terrifying movie. And it's a very traditional kind of story. But the director, James Wan, you know, he has this really offbeat sense of pacing that keeps you on edge through the whole movie. And he knows he uses these dark spaces and the little creaks that a house makes and stuff like that to build tension. So even though you kind of know what's coming, he messes with you and messes with your expectations just enough to scare you.
Meredith, in the last 3 years, how many ghost stories have you collected as part of your project?
Well, we've collected the first 10, and we won't do more until we have a second zine out. And I will say that it's my not having finished the first portfolio and given it to those artists that's, like, stalling me out. So, you know, curate is like 10 or a million shows a year, so they get in the way. But the project is attached to that of a local artist, Dustin Williams and John Lynn, who do installations that coincide with our ghost shows. And I'm pushing them to do a 10-year series, and we're in our third year right now. So I think that by the time the 10th year hits, we will have collected 100 stories, and they'll probably be spread out through 3 to 4 different zine anthologies.
So first, I want you to tell us just a little bit more about the installations, and then I want you to give your advice on what distinguishes a successful ghost story from a flop of a ghost story.
Okay, that was a two-parter. First part, talk about the exhibitions.
Correct,
the
yes.
ghost stories. So when 100 Ghost Stories first began in 2012, we, of course, had the 100 Ghost Stories set up in the gallery with the prints. And then in the secret hallway and back room, Dustin Williams and John Lynn created an installation that's very immersive and made it seem as though a video rental store from the 1980s had suddenly appeared in our back room and was renting titles based on puns of real movies, but that were ghost puns. So it's a humorous haunted house installation. That gave way the next year to the Dead End Diner, which appeared in the same space and was a viable diner where you could get like flies with that or goulash. So the Dead End Diner, more puns, no pun unturned. And that was a really wonderful exhibition. And we actually have great reviews on Yelp. You can check out the Dead End Diner there. And this year, the third installation in the ongoing series of these ghost town businesses that keep reappearing will be, I can't tell you, it's under wraps.
Okay.
So you can check it out. But they all build together to tell a larger story of what happened to this town that it is now a ghost town.
Well, so what do you think, now that you've been collecting stories for a while and hearing people tell their ghost stories, what do you think does distinguish a really successful one from a flop, either in the story itself or in the telling of it?
I love that question. I do think it's very personal, so I can only speak to what I think is makes me enjoy a ghost story, which is vivid language, which we've discussed, I think, already. And I think a creative insight into not the thing that is scary, but the why it's scary to us. So, for example, BJ's story is great because parenthood is scary. And Caroline by Megan is great because the isolation idea and the idea that you don't actually know if Gerald killed his wife or if he was the ghost all along. So I think those are they. I'm no ghost story expert, though. And I will say, I do not like scary movies and will not watch them.
This is interesting. See, this is what I was kind of curious about, is not everybody loves being terrified. And some people like being terrified in different ways than others. Why do we like being terrified at all?
Well, I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that it's a way to face our fears. It's a way to face the unknown. It's a way to kind of get that out of our system in a safe manner. You know, I know people who will ride the biggest, baddest roller coaster, but they will not watch a scary movie because that's just not how they get it out of their system. You know, I will not go near a roller coaster, but I will marathon the heck out of horror movies all the time.
I will not do either one.
Whereas I got married on a roller coaster, but won't watch a scary movie. But I think that, you know, let's shout out to adrenaline. Hey-o, science.
Yep.
You know, we enjoy the rush of being scared.
One way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think that, you know, our brain chemistry is very, very powerful. And if it tells us we loved wanting, you know, screaming, then we're going to keep finding ways to do it.
Meredith, you like listening to, like, a ghost story being told, but do not like watching a scary movie.
Yes.
Do you think that there's something about an image that's different from conjuring in your imagination?
Absolutely. I prefer to conjure from my imagination. I prefer reading to watching movies in general. But I also think that I'm better able to suspend my disbelief when I'm hearing a story. And when I'm watching a movie, I often am watching for places where I don't believe the narrator. I like to believe in people, so it's easier through stories for me.
Like we talked about a minute ago, there is kind of a trend toward campy horror movies and toward the idea of things that are – that the idea of scariness is kind of funny on some level. Loie, do you find humor in watching horror movies?
It depends on the movie. I mean, I think there's been a trend the last few years of making more serious ones again. But, you know, we get embarrassed when we get scared. That's why people giggle after they jump in a horror movie. Mm-hmm. You know, we're like, oh, yeah, that was scary. And, you know, we like to make fun of our fears as much as we like to face them. So I think there's always an element of that, too. And you have to relieve the tension, especially in a movie when you're building. Somebody makes a joke. It helps a little bit, you know. But yeah, I think the funny thing is also a way of just the relieving the tension of it too. So
can you think of a really funny, really scary movie, like something that is both?
Oh, wow. The Cabin in the Woods is a good one because it's basically this meta deconstruction of horror movies in general. And it's incredibly funny and has really scary moments. And it's Joss Whedon who created Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So that's no shock at all. There are a couple of episodes of that that are the same way.
Well, Meredith, what about you? Can you think of any literature or art or movie that has combined humor and scariness in a way that was really successful in your mind? And don't say the next story because we're going to hear it in a minute.
Totally. Well, I do think Dustin Williams and John Lynn's exhibitions do that, but on like a really, like they are not even trying to scare you. They're trying to amuse you with cobwebs. But I really would like to see Cabin in the Woods. Love Joss Whedon, but I haven't. I enjoyed the Japanese horror musical, Happiness to the Katakuris. Has anybody seen that?
No.
It's fascinating. It was by a director who I think did The Ring or some super scary Japanese film. Huh. But then he was like, that was pretty scary, y'all. Let me give you something a little bit more lighthearted. So it's about like singing zombies. And
Cool.
It's good.
Well, it's time to listen to the funny selection we recorded from Wonderfair's 100 Ghost Stories project. This one's by Mick Cotton, and it's called Ghost Feelings.
I always wanted to be a decent ghost. Not that I'm doing so bad. I guess I've been doing the right things. I'm out there, sometimes where I can be seen. People say I look like a cloud. They say my face is asymmetrical, that I'm oddly pink and effeminate. They are right about these things. Some people say I look gay, lumpy, and like a scoop of melting ice cream. They call me the worst ghost ever. These people might be right too, but these people have a bad outlook on life. I usually hang out by walls. That's just where I'm most comfortable. I'm oddly two-dimensional. I don't like being snuck up on or walked through. When people walk through me, they often say that it was thick, moist, and smelled like a moldy fridge, a sack of bad fruit, rotten. People often call me it, and that hurts my feelings. I have feelings, and they're just the same as people feelings. People often ask me who I am. I'm a ghost, is what I would say if I didn't have a gaping black hole for a mouth. Some people think I'm their dead relative, that I'm trying to communicate with them, that I have answers. Is there a heaven? Why couldn't you say you loved me? Why did you do that to yourself? These are all very serious questions, and I would like to say to them, I don't know the answers to these questions. I'm just a ghost. But I have a useless hole for a mouth. I can't tell them anything, so I commit and listen with compassion. Ghosts have always been great listeners. People often reach out and try to grab me. They've never succeeded. They stumble forward and fall through me. I'd like to reach back at them and see what would happen, but I have no arms, no hands. I can't hug. I'd like to drink a glass of water, but I have no thumbs. Being a ghost means being thirsty. This is something you learn early on. We float and can move around. It's quite easy. I've been all sorts of places and seen all sorts of people. When you're a ghost, you like to watch, but you need to hide. Ghosts are creepy that way. I went to church once, but an old lady saw me and was convinced I was the Virgin Mary. People see what they want sometimes. I went to a wedding once, but I scared a plump kid by the cake and then he barfed. I've watched movies. I go to baseball games. Ghosts love museums, history, and culture. Ghosts love to learn about people just as much as people love to learn about ghosts. If we had a ghost TV, there would be shows about people. We would have whole channels dedicated to people. We would pay premium prices for the most award-winning people shows. If we had ghost TV, I wouldn't have to go out. I wouldn't have to be seen. I could just float and watch and learn. But we can't have ghost TV because ghosts cannot make things. We cannot produce TV shows or write scripts. Ghosts can't do much of anything. I loved a girl once, a person. She lived in a duplex I was haunting. I'd sit by the wall and she would cook herself vegan meals. She loved apple juice and had terrible taste in music. She would listen to her terrible music while doing dishes before bed. She liked to do this topless and I liked to watch. Sometimes she would forget to close the curtains while topless in the kitchen, and I would get upset that people outside might get to watch too. She had a dog that barked at me all the time. It wasn't a mean dog, it was just a dumb dog. Eventually, the people in the other half of the duplex complained. The police showed up and cited her, and then they showed up again. It took 3 citations and 1 fine before she had to get rid of her dog. This hurt her, and consequently hurt me. I watched her cry. I watched her get angry. And as time went by, I watched her move on. When she adopted another dog, it barked at me. I knew it was going to happen again, so I left. Ghosts and people just can't fall in love. It never works out. Now I hang out at crowded and poorly kept bars. Bright neon lights hang in the windows and lure people in. Inside it's dark and people don't trust their eyes after they've been drinking. I startle people, but they move along quickly. These days, I'm just trying to be next to a wall. I'm just trying to be a ghost. When I was young, I used to wake up and strive to figure out all those big, dumb, unanswerable life questions that have the potential to both inspire and ruin people. I'm getting old, and I'm fading away. Eventually, people will stop seeing me. The people who did see me will talk to their friends about it around Halloween, when it's acceptable for such things. But they'll mess up the details, they'll embellish, and essentially the stories will not be about me anymore. I've traveled, I've scared people, and I've loved a woman. I've lived something that has the impression of a person's life. I've lived the life of a ghost.
That was Ghost Feelings by Mick Cotton. Meredith Moore of Wonderfair, thanks for being here today.
Oh, you're so welcome. It was really nice to be here.
Wonderfair is hosting a haunted evening at a fictional ghost town tomorrow night at 7. For the occasion, the gallery will be completely transformed. That'll be at Wonderfair Gallery at 8th and Massachusetts in Lawrence tomorrow at 7. And Loie Lockerbie of the Kansas City Public Library, Kansas Public Library, I should say. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
Central Standard is going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll check in with Tell KCUR and get a recap of Game 7 from the perspective of those gathered outside the stadium in the parking lot. Stay with us.